Okay, so thank you all for coming. I think the first lecture after the holidays. So I hope you had a nice holiday and have a happy new year. Today, first of all, one of the things that we're doing is we're handing out the evaluation sheets. So you'll be given the evaluation sheet for you to fill it. After you're finished, drop it off in the left box at the end of the class. So that we can have a feedback on what we've done. We still have two more classes from my side. Today I'm going to really take a little bit of a digression, but try to go more into aspects of building large software. And then I'll come back in the next class to machine learning. Okay. So what we've done so far, so what have you seen so far in the class is that you actually have seen, first of all, you studied programming, Python, data structures, all sorts of stuff before, and then we actually went in and looked at especially the random surfer model, small worlds, and linked to the original lectures. Then what I tried to do in the first lecture was to give you an idea of you know, what kind of trends are there in software when it comes to large-scale software, intelligent software, and how it actually links to society. So it sort of gives you like an application overview, and then we went back into link to the past lectures. And then the last class was more a detailed example, not so much enough to get a very deep insight on what is image processing or what is involved in analytics. But at least you got an idea of the basics of how do you think about an image data type, how do you think about filtering, how do you think about an algorithm as being a combination of filters. So that's what you did last time, and you had a homework. I hope you finished the programming exercises, which involved actually using all the knowledge you have about Python user interfaces to develop actually an image editor and a manipulator. So this is basically what we've covered so far. Now, what is not covered, or at least what's basically beyond this, is that, okay, yes, we know something about programming and some examples of how programming impacts an application. But the question is, can you, when you talk about real systems and products that you build, how essentially, what is involved in actually building a complex software? Okay. So it is not just one person doing the software. You can do a program exercise, one algorithm, you can implement it, you can check it. But when it comes to building a complete autonomous car, building an airplane that autonomously flies, then you need lots of software people and hardware people working together to build these systems. So this means that you need not only have the skills for required for knowing about algorithms and implementation, but also you need the skills for how to work with people and a process by which you can build things. So in that sense, you need to organize and effectively deliver these systems. So that's essentially the focus of this class today. So the main point that I would like to highlight is, how do you think about specifying what you really want? So in other words, what is it that you're building? How do you actually build it? And then how do you test it? How do you deploy it and validate it? And what essentially is indeed sort of the methods and tools and processes and principles that go with it. It's actually a large field, but I'm trying to give you a high-level introduction to this field of software engineering. That's basically the class today. So what I will do, I have too many slides, but I will try to figure out how to skip some of them on the way. But what I will try to do is to show you first an example. And I take a real example of some system that I've developed with my team when I was in Siemens, where our team developed it over a period of 5 years. And to give you an idea of what essentially is a real-world product. And then in that process of how you actually build a product and check it, I'll try to highlight how programming comes in or how people, teams come in and how essentially the whole thing gets done. So in that sense, I try to explain to you a concrete example, and it ties back to also what you saw in image processing examples so that you get a feel for how the basic things that you looked at so far can apply. And then I go to some examples from software engineering. So how do you think about building the entire life cycle of a software? So from the point of view of an idea of a software to building it, testing it, going and deploying it, getting it used, and then retiring it. And then how some details of what is involved in specifying what requirements are, how you think about usability of a software, and what it could be if you don't design a software in a proper way. And then notion of architecture, how do you organize the software so that you can build on top of the past work and not throw away software that you developed. So that's in modularity, structuring, and then issue of testing. I'm not sure I can cover this much, all of it, but I will try to at least give you a flavor so that you understand and appreciate essentially what is involved in building larger things. So the goal of this class is mainly to introduce you to how to build more complex things, but introduce you to the point of view that you have to think about larger teams and working with larger teams, and also processes and tools. So let's take a concrete example of actually a system that we built, and it took basically a period of close to, actually it took about 5 years for the complete product line, but then it took about 2 years to build the first hardware product and software. So here is a concrete example of what happened. In the late 90s, actually, I don't know whether you have you've heard about this, there were lots of accidents. Accidents, for example, in tunnels, especially. There was a major accident in a tunnel where there was actually a fatal crash. And as a result, basically, people died. And so the goal was essentially, can we actually automate the task of looking into the tunnel, watching the tunnel, and before a real major catastrophe can happen, can I alert somebody so that you don't have such problems? So the goal was to build a system, a hardware, a software solution that will essentially reduce the chance of actually a catastrophe, or in other words, how to make a tunnel safe. So that's the high-level goal of the problem. And so essentially, the idea was to prevent accidents, death of people, and damage of the tunnels. So this is basically a real need. Then at the time, they went to Siemens and said, OK, can we build actually a system, something like this? And then Siemens decided, OK, we would build a system of this nature. So the idea was, OK, before actually an accident, let's say, real a fire in the tunnel, typically what happens is maybe a car is slowing down, stopping, and then maybe there's a coal fire, and then maybe there's a real fire. And the point is that, you know, obviously you don't want to respond when this is happening. You would like to respond on an early alert when already things are going in a situation where it could be unsafe. So in other words, there is a degree of unsafeness depending upon how congested the tunnel is, or maybe a person is standing there, you're not supposed to be standing, and so therefore things are slowing down, and so on. So in a sense, the idea was to use video. So you put a bunch of cameras, look at actually the tunnel, and you monitor the traffic. You essentially know what's normal, that is nothing is happening, and what's abnormal, meaning that potentially there is a danger. Okay. And the way you define abnormality is by saying that, okay, you have actually somebody slowing down, somebody stopping, somebody, maybe there's a smoke, maybe there is a fire, and so on. Yeah. So it means that you need to have different types of sensors and processing systems that will essentially analyze actually the video streams, and also maybe fiber sensor for fire detection, which essentially are integrated together in a command and control center where somebody's watching in the command and control center when actually some tunnel may be in danger. So that's the goal of the, let's say, the system. And then if you notice, okay, there's a lot of variability in these tunnels, okay, meaning that you can talk about, for example, different types of lighting, different weather conditions. Even though it's a tunnel, it's still wet, because when it's outside is wet and the cars come in and it's wet. And then there are different types of mounting constraints, so you only mount in some places. And you may have blooming, and you may have actually looking at, or maybe looking outside, and so on. Yeah? And so you see typical videos. If you see this, you can see that I guess I need to move. It's better to. It's better to draw it like that. Okay. So here you see, just to get an idea of what this system is supposed to do, you see, okay, here, oh, look at this, actually. This is after the tunnel has been installed, the camera has been installed in the tunnel, and after a while, you see that basically because of the way the weather condition is and the salt spray and how it actually is dispersed, you get blooming effects. And then you have essentially, for example, occlusions from the tunnel. You could have essentially different types of reflections and so on. So there's basically, this just specifies what is the problem domain, and in that problem domain, what kind of data you get. Yeah? And then here you see, for example, that you could also have variations in this thing, like changes in the light suddenly, because sometimes the light turns on at night and then turns off. And then you have actually basically different levels of traffic densities. And sometimes you may have to monitor outside the tunnel, looking outside when things are leaving. And this basically depends upon the day and night situation. You can have different pictures. And you have different types of errors. Maybe the camera essentially gets broken. For example, this looks like the sensor is already kind of saturated, and some pixels are bad. So essentially, the main point I put out that, why is the, I put out the videos in there, is because it's to just say, at a high level, I say I want to make a tunnel safe. Then the next thing essentially is, what is a tunnel? Then if the moment I say that I'm going to actually process this data, video data or sensor data, then I have to ask, what does the sensor data look like? And so what I tried to show you there was a sort of video collections, all the examples, many examples of video collections, showing a population of possibilities on which the software product has to work. So in that sense, it's more like a user-specified input, giving actually, these are the kind of scenarios I want to deal with. And then once you say that, then the user says what they want to do. Okay. In this case, the designer said, OK, I want to do all these things. The design says, OK, I want to recognize smoke. I want to do some sort of understanding of what is going on in the tunnel, know how many cars are there, what kind of type of cars are there, and is it a truck, and so on. I want to know if it's a slow traffic. I want to know if it's a traffic jam. I want to know if it's a wrong way driver. Somebody drives in the wrong way, and that's actually a dangerous situation. Then I want to know if there is somebody who stopped, and if there is a cargo which may drop from a truck, which is, again, a dangerous situation. And then I want to know if somebody's speeding and tailgating, and I may want to know if a person is there. So these are actually sort of functional specification of, or at least a functional statement about what might be needed from this system, from the software product. And it's, of course, a software and hardware product, because it's a hardware as well. It has to be at a certain cost. It has to essentially be available 24 hours a day. It has to know when it's not available, and so on. So all of these are requirements from the user about what this product is supposed to do. And then we have to take those requirements and then map it to actually a design. And so what we normally do in a, you have seen some image processing examples, and what we did as our team members is to take such description and then map it to models. I wouldn't go into detail of this, how we do it, because that actually is a complicated, is more involved, and it's a separate course in itself. But the main point is that if you can actually follow the logic is a user has a problem, you go and ask what the requirements, what they really need. From the requirement, you go to a skeleton design. You say, here are the sensors, here is how I'm going to measure data, here is going to how I'm going to try to come up with some sort of system. And then you say, here are the functionality I can deliver. And then you say, can I now flush out the details of what should be done for the design? Okay. And that is basically, I showed you machine learning examples, I showed you some other examples where you can take a lot of data and you can learn, so you can do that as well here. And or you can actually design the system architecture based on your understanding of what the requirements are. And in software engineering, there's a whole field called model-based software design which is says, here is my model of the problem, here is how it maps to a design. Okay. And that's exactly what we do in the context of image processing and vision model-based design. And from that, we come to a design of these filters and combinations. So you remember you in the last class, we talked about filters and then applying edge operators, applying warping, and so on. So those are the kinds of operators that are applied. And this is actually, by the way, a deep network. Just like you talked about deep learning in the last class, this is nothing but a deep network. Only thing is that the deep network is actually designed by a human expert, knowing actually the particular problem at hand, and then customizing that that solution to meet all the requirements, including computational accuracy, speed, performance, and then cost, and all the stuff. Yeah? And then you go through these, and normally what happens is you make one version, you go test it in the field, and then you integrate it into hardware, you test it, you then go through an iteration, check what the problem is, you improve it, and then you go through a cycle. And then you normally check in one tunnel, or maybe two tunnels, and then you expand it to more tunnels to verify. So that's typically the process by which you go from the formulation of what problem you want to solve to actually construction of a software system to actually testing, validation, and deployment and back. Yeah. So this is what it looks like, the first prototype. It's not even the last prototype, but the first prototype looks like this. It shows you, for example, oh, okay, I can recognize that the lane one essentially is congested. That's this one. And then there are slow vehicles in both lanes. They seem to be going slow. And then things can get to be stopped. Here it shows you that you can deal with tracking and detection and tracking of cars, even in the when you're looking from outside the tunnel. And I don't know why the, oh yeah, okay, it's starting to play. So and then here it shows you when the traffic, even if your occlusions are there, we can deal with occlusions. Yeah, and you can see it's pretty good in actually doing almost perfect detection, tracking, and so on, and measurement of these properties. Yeah, so the main point I wanted to, in this example, what I wanted to show you was that from this problem definition, going to these stages of actually some sort of a concept design to actually understanding what the context is, what the domain is, to then looking at these data sets, and then going to what kind of functions can be realized down to actually a more principled design, and then followed by actually a design and validation. So this is basically what I want to show you. And this normally involves an iteration process. And then you come to this type of a final system. Yeah. Now, this particular system, the first system that we did, just took about 9 months, 9 months to a year, for about, from a software side, for the computer vision side, three people, okay, involved in this. And then from the hardware side, it was a hardware product was much more, it was 10, 15 people, because they were building the complete recording system, complete compression system, storage, and transmission, and so on. And then we had to get our software into the hardware, and then we had to get this deployed. And then there was a process that took us about 2 years. But then to get the system out to the level of performance, which is 99.9999% performance, human performance, took some time. Because you have to go through the rigorous way of checking the different conditions, the extreme conditions that are there. Yeah. And often, the challenge essentially is in then building tools that will allow you to reduce the amount of work to monitor this stuff and to make sure that you don't waste your money in putting people looking at this stuff, but software tools are actually managing the deployment. Yeah. So that's basically an overview of an actual concrete example. Now, what essentially are the tools and processes that allow you to streamline this type of a development? Now, this is just one project. But if you imagine, that's only one concrete product involving a software system for monitoring. Now, if you imagine building a space shuttle and then sending a space shuttle and then to on a mission and then coming back, you need thousands of people. And you need essentially different disciplines. They have different strengths. And they come together, and then they do the simulation, model-based design, validation, up front before you actually build the shuttle. And then after that, they actually build the parts, test the parts, and then bring it together, and then you test it in very, very concrete stages, and then you release it. Such a mission normally takes a lot of resources and millions and billions of euros, right? So in that scenario, what you need essentially is also a very systematic organization, a process, and a structure by which you can manage it so that you are cost effective and you don't have failure. So your chance of failure essentially is almost zero. Okay. So that's basically what engineering practices are used for. And this is basically the field of system engineering and software engineering. They cover this. So systems engineering is actually a word that's used for a broader range of things, including hardware software, while software engineering is mainly addressing the software part of it. So now I'm going to, in the rest of the talk, I'm going to now go through some of the examples of software engineering. What is software engineering? What essentially are the processes? And what essentially are, what are the elements of software engineering that you need to be concerned about? And how does it go beyond programming? So that's basically part of my talk. So what is software engineering? The first thing that you have to notice is that software engineering is not programming. So programming essentially is basically I gave a particular specific algorithm or a particular definition of what exactly I want to implement. I map it to a particular code. And I have to focus on efficiency, I have to focus on the right data structures, and so on. That's at least at a component level a unit. But the software engineering is actually about bringing together pieces and then forming complex entities and then certifying that that complex thing that you build is actually going to work. So software engineering, broadly defined, is nothing but creating and maintaining software applications by applying technologies and practices from computer science, project management, and other fields. Notice this. It's not just computer science. It actually involves people skills. It involves management, psychology, and other things. And software engineering people, this is about people working in teams under constraints to create value for their customers. So I have to also point out right now before I start is that this presentation actually is largely based on one of the best software engineering classes in the University of Washington where I attended. So a lot of this information is borrowed from there. So if you, in the name of actually, in terms of one of the leaders in early software engineering, Fred Brooks, essentially he says software engineering, he paraphrases software engineering this way. He says, the first step towards management of disease was replacement of demon theories and human theories by germ theory. That very step, the beginning of hope, is in itself dashed all hopes of magical solutions. It told the workers that progress would be made stepwise at great effort and that a persistent, unremitting care would have to be paid to a discipline of cleanliness. So it is with software engineering today. So it's just saying that, okay, when we talk about complex things, understanding complex things, for example, something like disease, you understand actually the origins of disease, you understand the processes by which disease can arise, and instead of actually going to some archaic models, you try to dissect the problem into pieces and then you build up piece by piece by piece, essentially the foundations. And that's exactly what you do when you're building complex things from simple entities. But you need to have a structured and organized process and a way to verify that what you've actually built up essentially is indeed going to work within particular bounds. So what is the aspect of software engineering that's covered? So basically, software engineering covers processes, methods, and techniques that are necessary to turn a concept into a robust product, in this case. And ideally, it will evolve over time. So essentially, you just build a version of the software, and you refine it and refine it, but you actually are building, ideally, it would be actually built upon and revised. Sometimes it may be that you throw away the old design, redo it, but there is a process by which you manage this. Often, in any real-world problem, you don't have unlimited time. You don't have unlimited resources. So you need to do this within a cost budget. Therefore, you need to be able to be practical. And that's why this becomes more an engineering problem and not a pure science problem. And then it has to satisfy ultimately you. So if you are in a tunnel safety system and you're running, you assume that the system is operating, you would expect that if there is a real problem, it's going to fix it. It's going to find it. If it doesn't, then obviously this product is actually not working. So therefore, ultimately, the customer has to be satisfied in the end. And that's why you use the software product. Then you have to be able to manage the risks in the complexity of the software and how to make sure that whatever you deliver, you know, because ultimately we are doing this within particular trade-offs. So you need to also, there's a trade-off into risk as well. And in order for you to deliver big things, bigger projects, bigger complex solutions, you need to work in teams and you need to work together with people. So that means that people skills are the most important. So that's basically all of these elements are what is taught in a software engineering master's degree. Okay. And if you notice this, you see there are too many of these fields that are tied together. For example, it involves computer science because it involves algorithms, data structures, programming languages, and tools. It involves business and management because it involves project management, scheduling, and doing this on time. And then it involves economics and marketing because you need to know how the product is sold. It involves communication because you need to have many people, different people playing with different hats, and you need to communicate among them. It involves law because sometimes you need to know, okay, what software is actually open source, what's not, what is restricted, and so on. And then it involves sociology in terms of ethics, and then it involves political science, psychology, art, because ultimately the best software, for example, includes a user interface that actually is intuitive and easy to use, and that involves more or less creative art, like an Apple iPad, for instance, interface. So essentially what you're talking about is that software engineering involves a softer aspect of actually a discipline than the other parts of computer science. And there are fewer really clearly right and wrong answers. Because ultimately the point is that you're working within trade-offs and designing things. There are guidelines, but you need to ultimately decide based on the situation what's the right answer. So effectively that's one of the main elements that that makes it more an engineering practice. So who are all the people involved in software? Yeah. So you, for example, ultimately the software is being used by somebody, the customer. So in this case, it's the customer or client wants a software built. And then there are managers who actually build the software product and deliver it in time. So essentially they are actually making the plans, they're making the project plans, they coordinate the team so that the project can actually complete in the proper time. And then there are developers who essentially design and write the code, actually. And then there are testers who actually make sure that whatever you developed is actually going to perform within the specs. And there are the users, ultimately, who essentially purchase the product and use it. So essentially, by the way, the user and the customer may be different. For example, the customer might be actually the business which is going to sell the product, whereas the user may be the end user. Okay, so. Essentially, you see, the other problem is that if even though you know that there are many of these different people, often the problem is that you don't know what you really want. For example, when you build a product, you don't really know upfront what the product is going to be like, what you want. You just have an idea of what might be, but you don't have an exact specification. Similarly, the managers cannot foresee everything upfront. And similarly, the developer cannot write complex code for all large systems in time and budget. And the testers cannot test every possible combination of actions. And the users may be basically want it to be perfect without any training. So in that sense, some people may be more willing to spend some time with the tool, some people not. So essentially, this means that there are a lot of trade-offs here, and there's a lot of uncertainty and variability that make it hard for you to design software and to get the software out into the hands of people so that it can be used day in, day out. So this actually shows you the complexity of actually how to go from and build actually a real product. So how does a software project look like? A software project looks like essentially, ultimately you want a software deliverable. You have three basically alternating constraints. For example, you have a particular constraint on time, particular constraint on resources, and the kinds of things that you can do on the feature and quality. Of course, I can keep on adding more and more features and quality, but if I cannot do it in time and within a particular finite resource, then it's useless. Similarly, you cannot ask for very limited resource and a lot of features, and so on. So therefore, you need to find a balance between these three quantities in order for you to come up with actually an end product. And so the point is that you can talk about which of these things, elements, you can actually afford and figure out what the trade-off is. So far what I have tried to give you is an example of an application, and then examples of what essentially is involved in constructing a software, what is in general software engineering, and who are the people involved in a software engineering project. Now let's talk about how do you go about, what is the process by which a software is constructed, and what are the models by which you can go about it? Are there always one way to do a software project? Or is there many different ways to do a software project? And why are there different variations in the software project? So in this part of the talk, what I'm going to talk about essentially is some examples of different ways you can build software in teams and why those different ways actually make sense or not make sense. So basically the definition is whenever you're building a software, it has a life cycle. What is a life cycle? A life cycle essentially means that your conception of actually what the software product is, the actual design, conceptual design, to actually building the software, and then testing the software, bringing it into the device, taking it in the field, and then going in and getting it used. And after it's used, the version number changes, and now suddenly I update the software. And this software may be, in the end, let's say, no longer needed, so it's retired. So a life cycle is nothing but the whole process all the way from the start to the end of actually the entire product. So all the way from the conception of the design of the product down to essentially the end, essentially, use and retiring of the product. So in a life cycle, essentially, you have many stages of development. And you need to ask yourself, what essentially would be a process for the life cycle? And why do you need a life cycle process? And then we talk about different types of life cycle models. And how can we evaluate which way to go about building a software product? So here is basically the typical stages in a software product development. The stages involve, for example, starting with requirements, meaning what do I really want in this software? And then how do you translate that back to a design? So what actually is the software elements that are there? How does the modules look like? What data structures do you use? How do I interact? What objects you use and what kind of methods and so on. And then from there, you go to actually the implementation of the thing and in code. And then you go to the testing. And then you talk about maintenance of the software, bug fixing and changing the fixing the software for any minor errors and maybe major errors, and then updating it regularly so that software is always functional. So you really have the cycle, essentially, all the way from requirements to maintenance that essentially are the tasks involved in a software project. So the formal definition of a software life cycle is, the software life cycle is a series of phases through which the software is produced, from the conception to the end of life, and can take months or years to complete, in a sense. So it could be that it could be a few months, or it could be years. And the goal of each phase is to mark out explicitly what steps you will perform in each of these steps. And it will produce a tangible item and the transfer. And it will allow, actually, because it involves multiple people and working together across in teams, you need to have an organized way in which you can verify and review each stage of the work and then make sure that things are complete. And you can also talk about what is the next action step to be performed. And why do you need a process? So you need a process whenever the things, problems are basically getting too complicated and it's basically costly if you make mistakes. For example, if you actually look at the time, if you look at the phases of software development, You start developing the product, you do the testing, you do the quality assurance, new production. Now, if you have to fix bugs at this stage, then you have to go and redo all this stuff, which means that the cost of actually fixing software bugs at a later stage is often very costly. As a result, it's better to have actually short iterative cycles by which you can evaluate and test and fix. So for example, airplane crash actually happened because there is a bug in the requirement process. So you can make mistakes in every stage. So if you make a mistake here, that mistake propagates all the way to here. So essentially, early identification of what mistakes you can make here will essentially help you in reducing the chance of failure. So, so for example, a real crash resulted in essentially because of a bug in the software requirements. So the life without software processes, okay. So of course I could go and do this thing without software processes. I can do this as, okay, I say I can, I know how to code, I have module by module, I know how to bring it together myself, maybe even in a smaller team I could probably interact and make it work. But the problem is that if you want to certify anything and if you want to maintain it or extend it, it will be a problem in the long term. So if you want to do this without software processes, the main advantage essentially is that you don't have anything to learn or plan. You just do it on your own. On the other hand, you work on whatever is interesting and ignore the rest. So these are advantages. On the other hand, if you look at actually disadvantages, you, for example, may overlook essentially the important task. It's not clear when to start or stop doing each task. It scales poorly to multiple people. It's hard to review and evaluate each one's work. Code may not match the user's need. Code was not planned for modification and not flexible. So essentially, the point essentially, what I'm explaining here is pretty much common sense, but it makes a lot of importance when you deal with large software and large projects. And that's why the software engineering field actually is involved in actually doing this. For example, if you are an automotive manufacturer and you're building actually the autonomous car, you're talking about millions and millions of lines of software code, and you need to make sure that all of them are certified. And that requires actually a detailed process. And so here is an example of how, if you have a process, or not have a process, what might happen in a project. So here is, for example, the beginning of the project, and here is the end of the project. And if you look at the productive work, essentially, and if you don't have any process, what happens is that the productive work initially seems to be productive, but over time, it seems to be dropping, and then suddenly you are thrashing, which means that you're essentially wasting your time largely in dealing with fixing problems. Whereas, if you actually pay attention to the process upfront and the organization, what happens is that your thrashing levels go down, and actually the productive work is almost basically positive and growing. So this essentially is a clear illustration of how processes essentially will help you in basically getting results which are effectively streamlining your risks. So what this part of the talk gives you essentially is to give you, main point is that for pay attention to the process. So what are the types of processes that exist? Yeah. So there are actually five type of models that people use. And I'll go through them one by one. So first one is that why don't we just code and fix it up later? That's the simplest one. So you don't have any upfront thinking on what would be the design like. So you just basically go through the stuff, you prototype and check it. And this, I think, may be okay for very small checking of ideas just to get a feel for whether an idea that you have makes sense or not. And that is one type of a model. The other model, which is very detailed and very complex, is what's called a waterfall model. And this is actually what is used when you, for example, build a space shuttle or you send a man to a moon or a man to Mars. That's basically a typical process that's used. And this one is basically very structured, very organized, and detailed, with very specific detailed tracking of what's being done. And that's a waterfall model. The third model that is used is what's called a spiral model, where you essentially are figuring out what are the risky things early on, and then addressing them, and then iteratively changing it. And I'll show you the example details. And then the fourth model essentially is a staged delivery model, and then the more recent one, evolutionary prototyping, is actually a refinement of that. So basically, depending upon the nature of what exactly your goal is, so if you're mainly interested in just checking some idea, then it may be just enough to do a little program and check it. If you're interested in sending man to the moon, and the software has to be critical, safety critical, and work without any failure, and you put lots of money, you need actually a more structured, very structured process. If you're interested in actually quickly getting a product into the hands of the user, checking it and then going back, then there is actually an agile process you can follow. So there are different types of processes that you will use depending upon the particular nature of the situation that you have, the requirements you have. So what is the caught and fixed model? The caught and fixed model is, okay, hey, I don't even think about requirements. I just think about some idea, I code it up, and then I may release it. Yeah, but that's basically just plain simple programming, prototyping. And the advantage of such a thing is that it has little to no overhead. You can see progress quickly. It's very good for very, very small projects and very short-lived prototypes. So if it is basically a very simple prototype that you want to try out and check how it is, it's okay. And doesn't have overhead. On the other hand, the disadvantage essentially is that you cannot assess progress, you don't have quality, you have risk essentially, and you're not able to change without major design changes. So it's only even the knowledge of what's in the software might be inside the head of the programmer, and it's not clear what kind of results you'll get, how you can time your deliveries. It's more or less this is involved for very small projects. On the other hand, the waterfall model, which is actually what I mentioned about when you talk about large projects like sending somebody to Mars. In this project, what you need essentially is a very detailed illustration of what exactly do I really want to do? And you have actually a large document that describes what are the requirements. How would I actually validate the requirement? So this essentially is thought up front. And then what are the software requirements? So these are system requirements, the hardware requirements. What are the software requirements in terms of the software? And then can I talk about a preliminary design or a skeleton design for this thing? And then can I go to a detailed version of the design? Can I actually even simulate the design up front and check it and then validate it? And then can I then translate that thing back to an example code and debug it? And then from there, can you go and test it and validate it and then go to operations? And you see that there's actually loops here, essentially, which are actually feedback loops, which make sure that there is consistency across each of these things. This is a very much a linear stage. So whatever you define up front in the top is not changed after actually this stage, for example, and you're already implementing and you're going down. So the problem essentially with this model is that if something goes wrong in the end, propagating it back is a problem. And in fact, it makes you spend more time up front in detailing what you want to do. And it may make sense for projects like sending man on the moon, because there you have to plan up front every detail and write it down. Whereas if it's actually a much more smaller project, like building a user interface for an iPad or an iPhone for an app, it may not be the exact thing you want to do. So, but nevertheless, this is actually one of the classic models in software engineering, and everybody knows it. And it's used still in very specific projects. For instance, sending the Mars rover, that was actually following this model. Or actually this, I think you may know, this was the healthcare website that was actually rolled out, the government healthcare in the US in the 2014. And that follows something like a large software project model, which involves actually detailed specification, validation, and so on. And normally these projects involve millions of dollars of software development work. Okay. And in that scenario, it makes sense to follow a very structured process. Yeah. And so here is a summary of what I said. It's suitable for projects that are very well understood but complex. It tackles all the planning up front. The ideal of no midstream changes equates to an efficient software development process, because once I fix something, I can then follow, so I don't really change the development process. It also is a way to decompose, and I can have inexperienced teams, and I can have different people, according to experience, I can put them in the right place. So that's actually an advantage in this model. And there are reviews at each stage that determine if the product is ready to advance, so that you don't go to the next stage unless the previous stage is finished. But the main disadvantage, essentially, is that you have a lot of planning up front, which is not always easy. Yeah? And then it's rigid, and it's linear, and it's not adaptive. And you can't change your mind after you've actually defined the project. And then there is no sense of progress until the very end, because you don't really see the product up front. You only see it in the very end. And so you don't really show anything until almost done. And then the other thing is that the integration occurs at the very end, which basically is an issue, and the delivered product may not match customer needs. So this is basically the disadvantage of a waterfall model. But nevertheless, in large projects, complex projects, it actually makes sense when you want to have certain type of rigor and certification, and when you have can afford to take the time up front to do all the details. Now, what about the spiral model? The spiral model essentially takes this thing in a different way. What it does is, it goes through in a spiral mode, as you see. And here, what happens is that you start with actually a concept of what your requirements is, and then you go and say, okay, what is my concept of operation? And then what is my requirement plan? And then you do an analysis of the risks, and then you build up a prototype to mainly address the key risks early on. So therefore, you essentially are building a prototype in stages, and then you are repeating them effectively in a spiral model. So essentially, the same thing repeats over in the next stage, the same thing again repeats in the next stage. So what is the advantage of this is that you've broken up this other model into stages, and then you're doing risk assessment at each stage, and then you're affording to look at the main risky elements early on and then go step by step. Right? So this is actually a better model if you want to have more shorter results, but at the same time you can manage the risk iteratively. So essentially the main advantage of this type of a model is that it's especially appropriate at the beginning of the project when the requirements are still fluid. It provides an early indication of the unforeseen problems. It accommodates change. And as costs increase, risk decrease, always address the big risk first. So you see that essentially the spiral model keeps some of the advantages of the waterfall, except that you are doing it in spiral mode. And you see that there's a lot of planning and management which is going on. And that's a disadvantage. And there's a frequent change of task because you're going through the spiral. And then you have a requirement, the customer and the contract flexibility has to be there, and the developer should be able to assess the risk. So this is also a model that's used in some of the software projects. And the third model that is an alternative is that you can do it in stages. So what you can do is you can say, I have a complex set of requirements, I can break it into stages, and I can organize it in nested form, and then I can deliver it. So here is actually another example of where the requirements go into a design process, and then you go through a stage 1 through N, and then it's more like waterfall in the beginning, and then you have short release cycles. And this is actually also very well used in the software teams. And the main advantage of such a model is that you can actually ship at every end, and you are able to see results every short cycles. And intermediate deliveries show progress, so the people are actually excited. They see the actual thing, they can use it, they can get a feel for it. And problems are visible early, so you know what's going on. And then it facilitates shorter, more predictable release cycles. In fact, this is very useful and practical and used more often. So in that sense, what you did was you took the waterfall model, but then you broke it down into more shorter, manageable chunks and iterations. But the disadvantage of such a staged delivery model is that it requires tight coordination and documentation, management, marketing. The product must be decomposable into parts and in stages, and you need different release overheads. And there is a lot of the last part of the one, which is called evolutionary prototyping, where you basically allow things to be more fluid. You start with an initial concept, you design and implement an initial prototype, and then you refine, basically using a refinement cycle, and you release. So there is a, it basically, it's again another variant of the other models, and essentially you're talking about building some sort of a rough skeleton, and then iteratively changing the skeleton. Now, it's different from the stage delivery in that the requirements are not known, so you allow the requirements to change. So if you notice this, here the requirements actually are fixed, and then there is an iteration which are changing, but in stages, mainly to address the nesting. Here, the requirements are not fixed, and they can be changed over time. So that's basically another type of a life cycle process. And the advantage of such a prototyping thing is that it addresses the risk early, it studies signs of progress, again, useful when requirements are unknown or changing, and participatory design useful feedback loops. So again, what you have to see is that the main reason for these different alternative ways of doing things is because you don't know upfront at all early on at times what exactly I want to do in the software product. So if I knew what they want to do in the software product, then I could of course specify it and I can try to go through the stuff. And this actually is one of the biggest challenges in building large software. You, what essentially should be the features inside the software, what is the way in which I want to use it, and even how you may not even foresee all the possible use cases for your software up front. So therefore, essentially, this essentially is quite a fuzzy, let's say, definition of what is actually up front you don't have. So in a sense, what you have to do is you have to decide based on the situation which model makes sense and then go with that. And you gain by, you learn by experience which essentially model matches what situation and through actually engineering work that you do in the field. So the disadvantage of evolutionary prototyping is that, again, there are requirements that, okay, you have to know a customer has to be involved and you have initial specifications that's flexible and you have problems with planning, integration problems, and so on. So, so the main point that you have to get from this part of the talk is that not all software projects are the same. Software products have different requirements, and the nature of software, what you're constructing, is not necessarily even known upfront. Depending upon the nature of the requirements in terms of the complexity, in terms of the accuracy, and so on, you may have different type of life cycle that you need to use. And these different types of life cycle processes will be, you have to choose which one is right depending upon the particular situation. So essentially, that's what's summarized here. The choice of which of these life cycle models depend upon the project circumstances and requirements. A good choice of a model can result in a vastly more productive environment, and a cocktail of models is frequently used in practice. So, and how do you decide what is best? You basically define based on the current task, the risk management, cost control, predictability, visibility of the progress, and so on. And the main point is to look for good, fast, and cheap, but you can't have all of this at the same time. So again, it looks very much like it's almost common sense, but the reason for actually presenting this in a more and organizing it more in a structured form is to reduce the amount of risks, overhead, wastage of time, increase efficiency of the software production, and reducing the cost, and so on. So essentially, it is more about the engineering processes required to build something within time and budget. So in summary, what I've talked about now essentially is that you can think of actually the software having as a life cycle, and these life cycle models are nothing but management tools, and essentially it's a system for organizing how to organize the work among workers. It essentially makes you forecast and plan upfront. It splits the work into smaller practical units. It supports feedback, and essentially it basically allows you to production in basically very regular timescales. And it also scales up the complexity of what you can deliver. And the main limitation is that it could be imposed artificial design constraints, and you are emphasizing more structure and process an organization than purely the results. So, but again, this part of the talk is being included in the class mainly to show you that programming is actually an elementary part of what you need to do for developing software, but software projects are more complex and involve actually a broader range of the skills involved, which involves bringing together people and getting them to work together in teams and organizing in the process so that you can actually get projects done. So let me now see how much time I have. Okay, I do have, I think I have enough, should be able to cover the rest. So let's now talk about actually why is it so fuzzy? What is so fuzzy about software requirement? So what essentially is a software requirement? How do you gather and find out the requirement? And how do you document the requirement? And what should you include in a requirement document? And what do you omit in the requirements? So when you, whenever I think about a system, you think about following views of a system. There is a user view of the system. How does the user interact with the system? What essentially does the user want out of the system? There is a modeler's view of the system. So in other words, what essentially is the internals of a system? How do you think about the input-output characteristics of the system? And then what essentially are the abstract representations for the system? It's a modeler's view. And then there's the implementation view of the system, meaning how do you take such abstract models and map it to implementation, actually code and artifacts? And then there is a tester view of the system, which is how do you test it to make sure that it's meeting all the requirements that I have? And then there is the validation part, and then there's deployment and use again. Now, the requirements part of it is always about the user view in this case. The user view essentially is saying, what do I really want the system to do and not how? Because the user doesn't know how the system can be built. So I may say, recognize all the faces in the picture, but I don't know anything about face recognition software. Therefore, all I tell you essentially is just give me a software which can, within a millisecond or 2 milliseconds, recognize the face. But I don't tell you exactly how to do it. So in that sense, it's a what and not how. And then you tell the problem, not the solution. In the tunnel example, I said, make the tunnel safe, but I didn't tell you what the solution is. Somebody had to come up with actually what the actual solution is. Then I may give you a little bit more about functions, what functions I may want. And then reflect the system design, not software design. So it just gives you a high-level idea of what the system should be on software design. For example, just to be clear about what this means, what versus how is always relative. For example, if you take actually an input data file and you want to process the input data file, input file processing can be, say, if you use the word input file processing, that's what you want to do with the input file. But how do you process the file, in this case, building a parser to parse the strings and then understand essentially what the nouns and the verbs and so on are, that's actually effectively the how part of it. Yeah? So in that sense, basically the what specifies, oh, tell me all the nouns and verbs in the file. And then the how may be actually how actually you go about doing the thing. Right? Similarly, once you say, I do the parsing of the sentence, then you can say, oh, that is actually the what. But then you go to the next level, oh, I do it by using a stack implementation, okay? And then you say, oh, how do I implement a stack? The stack is the what, an array or linked list is the how. So I can actually use an array for and implement the stack using an array, or I can use a linked list and build up on the stack. So you see that essentially depending upon the actual, you can talk about what a problem is in abstract. The how you implement the problem essentially is not, and solve the problem is actually the how. And what you usually specify as a problem is the what. And this is relative, depending upon exactly where, which, who is doing it, and what stage, what level of software you're in. So in other words, one person constant is another person's variable. Yeah? So what is actually, so what is the advantage of having requirements? The advantage of a requirement is that they help you to understand precisely what exactly are you building? And then it understands you how to communicate between myself and another person, what essentially am I building? And it controls the production so that we make sure that what I build essentially, we and I can agree that essentially this is actually meets the spec. So here is actually an illustration cartoon of what goes on in a requirement process. So this is a classic thing that people show you. So here is a customer says, okay, I want something like a swing with this and this and this, okay. And that's the customer's explanation. The project leader said, oh, okay, no, this is not what I want. He understood it as this way, so he made it like this, okay. Then the analyst who looked at it and said, okay, no, 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 this is, he interpreted this guy's statement and made it like this. The programmer actually decided to write it like this. The sales executive decided, okay, this is what it is with the sofa, okay? All right. And then you have the project which is documented. Okay, you see, project was documented at all, nothing, okay? Then you have the operations which actually installed it like in the end, this. And the customer was built like basically something like this, and the help desk essentially supported like this, and the customer really needed this, okay? So it is very clear from this example, the problem really is the humans. Right? Ultimately, we are using language which is improper, or let's say, is used for communication, effective communication in context. So obviously, human language is actually very good for compressing information. It's a code. It's a coded language that is used, very useful, and I can, in context, when I know a person, understand what the person is saying, or I pretend to understand what I'm saying. Maybe I do get 80%, maybe 90%. If I know them very well, 99%. But when you build actually ultimately something which is up to specification, you need actually more precision on what you're talking about. And that is why requirements documents, requirements formalism is important. And language evolved not for software, at least the spoken language did not evolve for software needs. So the role of requirements essentially is to make sure that each of the people that we talked about before, the customer, the manager, the designer, the programmer, and the quality assurance guy, they have a common view of what they are doing. And depending upon what their role is, they may have different reasons to look into the requirements. For example, a customer will say, oh, what day I'm expecting to be delivered? What is the contractual base? A manager says, oh, here is how I think about the progress indicator and schedule. A designer says, here is how the spec should look like, given that requirement. And the programmer essentially talks about what could be the implementations. Similarly, the quality tester uses the requirements for validation. And you can talk about different types of requirements, some of which are very precise, functional. I can say, OK, build an algorithm for checking whether a person is smiling. That may be a functional requirement. But the non-functional requirement is to what accuracy, to what speed, what kind of redundancy you need, and so on. So meaning that these are all auxiliary requirements which are good to have, which are not specifiable exactly as a logical statement. Yeah. And so therefore, you have both functional requirements which map input to outputs, and here you see, for example, the user can search either all databases or subset, every order gets an ID, and so on. So this is actually a functional statement. But a non-functional statement, things like dependability, reusability, portability, scalability, these are all nice to words which actually look nice, but ultimately when it maps to a particular software, they have a fuzzy meaning. So you have to think about what it really means, but normally in a software specification you have both of these aspects, functional as well as non-functional. And classifying requirements is actually, it could be also behavioral. It could also be based on quality attributes. Yeah. And in fact, depending upon the nature of the task, you can have different types of types. For example, what is the feature set for the software? What should the GUI requirements be? What kind of performance you want? What reliability you want? How do you expand the software? What kind of plugins? And then what kind of environment which software has to run? These are all examples of requirement types. And in fact, the reason why you write requirements is because you want to have the user involvement up front, and you want to go to the user first and then talk. So normally in these projects, what happens is that the user you go to the user, you sit down, you write down, and talk about what exactly the intended use case, and then you make up actually a summary. And so you need actually a requirement document. Involving users early on helps the project succeed much better. And so here is basically a statement from one of the Microsoft guys. Early easy access to end users is a critical success factor in rapid development projects. So again, you can clearly see if your end user is really involved, then you get actually the ultimately software you produce is used. For instance, good relations improve development speed. It improves perceived development speed. And also, the problem is that users don't know what they want. So by engaging the user overall, you're able to iteratively figure out what they want and improve it. So here is a cartoon again illustrating this requirement process. So here you see how this goes through this, right? I'll need to know your requirements before I start design software, this person says. First of all, what are you trying to accomplish? It goes to the user. I'm trying to make you design my software. I mean, what are you trying to accomplish with the software? Then this person says, I want to know what I can accomplish until you tell me what software can do. And then the person says, try to get this concept through your skull. The software can do whatever I wish to design it to do. Then he says, can you design it to tell me my requirements? So I think that this is just, these are jokes, of course. But the point essentially, ultimately, is that it is, all of this thing goes back to the point that when you're building essentially something for human use, the humans have particular implicit models of what they're expecting, and they often don't know what they're expecting. So therefore, as an iterative process that you need to actually gather and to have a common understanding of what exactly you're trying to build and then go forward. And then having actually a process by which you can produce something in the short term, which are then evaluated so that the person can get an early assessment, is more helpful than having something which is at the very end after you spend a lot of time. So this is basically the main message from such a slide. So the key point is that you have to talk to the users, you have to work with them, you have to learn how they work, because ultimately you're trying to do something to help them in their day-to-day work. Therefore, you're trying to basically, the software is for an automation purpose, therefore you would like to have actually a better tool that is helping them. So the user is involved, involvement is important. Ask questions throughout the process to dig for the requirements. Think about why users do something in your application, not just what. So in other words, actually, you need to know what essentially is the benefit of a particular function, so you can prioritize these functions. And then allow and expect these requirements to change later. So this basically gives you a flexible way to interact and build a software specification. And how not to gather requirements. So you don't talk about complex business logic. You want to be too detailed or specific. Describe the exact user interface. Try to think of everything ahead of time. You will fail. Clearly. And avoid unnecessary features not wanted by customers. Because ultimately, if you're an engineer, you want to put as much as you want into the system because you less like to do things. But in the end, you want to focus on the critical parts which are important for actually the software product. And the way to document these requirements, there's what's called a DRY principle, which says don't repeat yourself. And try to be compact and precise. That's the main idea. And also don't do premature optimization and let it be flexible. So this is basically the main element for requirements. So in a sense, basically, if you want to talk about user interfaces, there are ways in which requirements are specified. Normally, use cases, they say, here is a scenario. Here is how I expect the system to work. And you can document these in terms of use case diagrams. And I think you have already a presentation on UML, which was described by Professor Mailer. And that has a use case description as well. And you can talk about prototyping. You can prototype something to see what requirement makes sense. You can define use cases. You can define a feature list. You can do a prototype of a paper user interface. Or you can do a formal specification. These are all different ways to do specifications. So in summary, what we are saying is that when you're building something more complex, have a process and understand that actually having actually a meaningful dialogue, an iterative dialogue, understanding what the real need is, and understanding the domain of the person, and understanding what essentially your tool is going to do for them, and then mapping it to actually very concrete definition of what the high-level goal is, would basically be a most important part to be knowing exactly what you're going to do in the project. So effectively, here is a nice cartoon. The project requirements are forming in my mind. That's what this guy says, Dilbert. Now they're changing. Okay, no wait, changing, done. Then they say, okay, naturally I won't be sharing any of these thoughts with the engineering. That's what he says. I budgeted for some goons to build out of you. Okay, so the key point is again that find a way that requirements are not the high level goals of what you want to do. You get a good understanding by interacting with the user, but also have a flexibility to evolve it as you build a product and change it so that you can be flexible. So now what about user interfaces? Because this is another major element of software. So when you talk about software, a lot of the analytics and so on is only in the back of the software, in the core of the software. But what is in the front essentially is the user and the interaction of the user with the software. So one of the key elements essentially of a good software that will be either used or not is how good is it for the user in the end and how flexible and ease of use you have. So normally you talk about in user interfaces, what is the usability of the software? What kind of, how can I prototype it? And then what are the kinds of elements in the user interface design examples? So I'll cover some of the elements here. In fact, there are a whole range of examples of very bad user interfaces. I don't know if anybody of you have used this bad clip. There's this paperclip thing in Microsoft Word that essentially will pop up and then start to give you advice on what essentially you should be doing. And people started using it, and then they got fed up of it and turned it off. That's a clear example of a bad user interface, because they didn't anticipate, essentially, how to build up the interface so that the user can actually seamlessly interact with it and really be happy with it. So this actually is a key element. So getting the user interface right is going to be a major challenge. So what is usability? Usability essentially is an effectiveness with which users can accomplish software tasks in a software system as measured by the learnability, efficiency, and safety. So in other words, if I'm actually a novice and I'm given this thing and I didn't know before, the user interface itself is very simple and I can see there's an arrow left, right, and then there seems to be a red button. I press it and I saw it does something. I already knew what this does in a matter of a second. So this actually is a reasonable user interface. Although I don't seem to still know what these two buttons below mean. It seems like maybe turning on and off the slide projector. Okay, but and then there are some numbers here which I don't seem to even notice. So frankly, I'm happy with just these three buttons and not the others. Okay. Now, as a novice, you could actually just get it because you just had some intuitive definition of what left and right means and what a button press means. And that's actually, it's easy to learn. I was able to do this in just a matter of a second. Is it efficient? Yes. Is it safe? Okay, I think it is safe because I've never turned off my projection while it's running. So in that sense, it's safe. So effectively, this is what goes on in defining a user interface, right? And the point is, ultimately, the user interface should depend upon the user and what the user wants to do. So if I'm an expert, I may be doing some more sophisticated things with the software, in which case I need efficiency, I need speed, I need shortcuts. Whereas when I have actually new users, I need learnability. I want to be able to easily learn what's going on. And in fact, you have a range of possibilities all the way from novice to expert. So no user is uniformly a novice or an expert. So depending upon the task also, you need to be careful about allowing certain buttons. So if, for example, this is actually connected to a missile launcher, obviously that's I don't want to have this button in here, which I press and then the missile launcher is turned on. So it's clear. And The point is that most of the time, a software or a product, hardware product, it gets used on based on the usability. So the usability is not there, people throw it away. So that's basically the study telling you that 50% of devices that returned, they returned because of usability problems. And in fact, I don't know whether you know, this is actually an island off the coast of New York, New Jersey, where they had a nuclear accident. And the nuclear accident was because of a mistake in the user interface. Basically, there was a warning system, and then the light turns on in the warning system when a particular valve shuts down. That's what it's supposed to be. But in fact, what they did was the software guy programmed it such that whenever the software did a on, he sent a message to the control console to turn on the light. But in fact, the actual state of the valve was not communicated. So the point is that in this case, the requirement was wrong. There was actually a mistake in how the implementation was done. And as a result, even though the valve was actually not shut off, the enunciator says it's closed. And the user thought, OK, everything is fine. And then there was a major accident, a meltdown. So this actually can go, so a simple malfunction or definition, maldefinition of a user interface specification can already cause big problems. And this is actually the illustration of that. It's in your slide. And the key point is good user interfaces are hard to design. You're not the user, ultimately. Users are always right, except when they aren't. So it's clear that it's user interface is really quite a challenging thing to do properly. And you normally do it by user testing and field study early on, your evaluation review by user interface experts. You do lots of prototyping and experiment, and you throw away, and then you get an idea of what user interfaces work best. And the key to success is that a good user interface focuses on the user and not on the developer of the system. So really, it's more about the user and the interaction of the user with the software. So let me just see where I am with respect to time. Yeah, I think the last, I'll try to finish this part. So if you see the logic of the presentation so far, so we started with actually, okay, here is a whole system, how it's done, a Rails example. Then we said, okay, what kind of, if you build complex software, what kind of organization and process you need? That's a life cycle. Then we said, oh, you need to be careful about specifying requirements, and there are different ways of specifying requirements. And essentially, what is the way in which you should interact with the user to gather requirements and organize it. And organizing requirements up front help you in making sure you don't have errors later. And then we went to user interfaces and said, OK, user is involved in the software interaction. And therefore, you have to be careful about how you build user interfaces and test them. So all of these are elements. Now, what about the actual software itself? What about the software architecture? What about the module structure? What about the code? So when you talk about a software architecture, when you talk about a complex thing, you have multiple modules and the interactions. They come together. And now you need to think about organizing it in a proper way so that you can actually build and evolve the software in a systematic way. So essentially, I will highlight in the next few minutes an overview of, you know, what do you mean by a software architecture, what does an architecture look like, and what is a good architecture, and some examples. I may not be able to cover everything today, but we'll try to at least give you the main elements. So here is a very nice quote from one of our famous computer scientists. There are two ways of constructing a software design. One way is to make it so simple that there are obviously no deficiencies. So the design is actually clean, and you can say, oh, there's no problem. The other is to make it so complicated that there are no obvious deficiencies. So it's so complex, I can't tell anything. Oh, hopefully it works. Yeah? So obviously, it makes sense to have a complex system where essentially it's composed of simple elements and guidelines, design guidelines, that allows you to explain the complex part in terms of the simple units and how the aggregation works. Okay. So essentially, you have a good model of the system and how the system is built. So architecture essentially is a key element of this. So essentially, what we talked about in the beginning was I have the user telling you the requirements. From there, I had to go to code. How do I do it? Now, I can do this by some sort of ingenious miracle. Assume that somebody, a genius, is going to do that, so I'm fine. Or I could actually say, no, I want to have a structured way of thinking about what essentially is the way you map these requirements to code, and there's an architecture for it. So the architecture is nothing but a high-level framework that allows you to build and evolve a software system. And so essentially, it is nothing but saying, okay, look, it's basically a bunch of blocks or modules and common connections, and these connections together describe actually the program or system. In that sense, it's more or less like a wiring diagram of a circuit or an engineering diagram for a particular complex part. But what essentially is a box do? What's an arrow? What about layers? And so on. So you can think of an architecture as components and connectors. Components define the basic computations, okay? And the connectors are nothing but the interconnections between these components. For example, a procedure call, an event announcement, and so on. The line between them may be fuzzy at times. Sometimes it may be a bit more fuzzy. But mainly the point is that there are blocks and connections, interconnections, and then you can have hierarchies, you can have actually nesting, and so on. And you've already seen in your past lecture UML. UML essentially is what's called Universal Model Language, or Unified Modeling Language, which essentially allows you to describe software. Okay. And it's basically a standardized way to describe and draw architecture. Why do I need drawings? Basically, the reason why you actually use drawings and diagrams is essentially as a way of communication between people of different backgrounds. Ultimately, different people have different backgrounds, but they have a foundational substrate, which is based on image analysis, text, and we understand relationships, and so on. So basically, software engineering processes use diagrams as a basis to communicate between a manager to actually an implementer, to manager to the user, and so on. So essentially, UML is actually a language that puts on paper what are the requirements like, what are the design like, all on diagrams. And that essentially is a medium for communication between different parts of the team. And it's used in the industry widely. And there are other tools as well, other than UML. And I use one of these languages called object process methodology for system engineering, which is also something about objects, interconnections between objects and processes. And basically, if you talk about architectures, a good architecture satisfies basically good, in a sense, has to satisfy what functions you put out, what performance requirement you have. It manages the complexity. It allows you to change these designs iteratively. It's concerned with all these non-functional requirements you talked about, reliability, safety, understandability, and so on. So essentially, the main idea is modularity and how to modularly separate stuff so that I can manage this stuff and explain it in a clean way. So in a sense, you're basically building, you can think of it as a course-defined description of actually the complete system design. And the architecture helps you in system understanding, interaction between the modules, reuse, because I can reuse parts in one application to another one. I can break down the work into smaller chunks, and I can describe how the connection looks like. I can evolve, actually, how the software goes forward. And I can talk about how this thing fits in work packages. And I can talk about, a diagram tells you something about how the system works. It's a picture which describes the structure of the system. And essentially, you know when software is modular, when it's decomposable. It means that you can take this whole and say, okay, these are the parts that make up the whole. And it's composable. You can compose these things together based on the parts. You can understand the logical structure of this software. You know how to adapt it to different situations. And you know, actually, why it's safe. And you can talk about robustness properties. So these are all the required needs for why you have to have structured, modular description of software and to think about architecture up front. And you can have, you've gone through object-oriented design in the class, so you can talk about what is a public interface, what's a private implementation, and what is a client module. And you can think about actually how to encapsulate them in a proper way. So this is part of the design. And in order for the properties of an architecture, you need to think in terms of coupling between modules, how you can have local cohesion in a module. And then you can also think about styles. You can talk about particular styles or design patterns, which makes you understand, okay, in this particular style, I can trust that these properties exist. And then you can talk about particular properties of components and how they match. So these are all actually tools that people use in order for you to manage essentially architectural design processes and to understand how architecture works. For example, coupling means that, okay, how do the interconnections work? And ideally, you would like to have loosely coupled than tightly coupled, because then if you have everything interacted with everything else, you obviously, if you change one part of the code, you have to change everything else. So these are all, again, modularity principles that allow you to distribute the work and actually separate out in a modular way the work. So here is an example where a class design links with everything else. It's almost tightly coupled. Whereas here, you see it's much more loosely coupled, and it's more easy to see that that design actually is more modular and structured. And in terms of cohesion, you're talking about, again, how tightly the operations inside that class are coupled together and belongs together. So again, this goes back into having clarity and understanding and essentially a local cohesion. Oh, see, now I did this, yeah? And then you have this idea of architectural styles, which is more about particular structures and architectures. And then you have this notion of component matching, which is about what kind of component elements and can actually match in what layers. So these are all types of tools that are available for actually making sure that you can build complex designs from parts. Unfortunately, I cannot spend a lot of time explaining this stuff, but the reason I put this up, essentially, is just to give you an idea that when you go from the basic programming skills to more complex software, the main elements that are important are understanding how that software engineering involves people, interaction, processes, management, along with actually proper design, use of tools, testing, and integration. Okay, and this actually becomes more less of a science and more of engineering, and it brings together many different aspects together. Okay, and I hope that this actually gives you at least an idea of some of the complexities involved in building actually larger scale systems, and at least gives you a window into what the software engineering field looks like. Yeah. So that was basically my intent in this class, and I hope that next class we'll go back again now to data analysis and spend the next class on machine learning.